It's the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Carrie Stearns. Carrie, welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here this morning. So the way this starts, and we already had a little discussion about this, is we're starting a little early today, so some people may dial in a minute or two or later. What are a few of the labels, or what's a story or two that we need to that would be a good place to start our conversation, so we can kind of get to know you and who you are and what you care about and what you're about. What's the starting point for you? Who are you?
That's a big question. Who am I? Well, at the moment, I would say I'm someone who just really wants to be here in the moment and enjoying entering life as it presents itself fully. And so it's not a time of great striving in my life. Mm-hmm. It's a time of really being with life as it is.
Right. And the pace at which you speak and the resolve with which you say that makes me feel like you're not trying to be in the moment, but you're being in the moment. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I think that's true. I think it's come to a place where there's a kind of settling. Mm-hmm. After a fair bit of seeking and turmoil in life. I'm entering my 50s with some real kind of centeredness and sense of purpose and joy.
And does that surprise you?
In some ways, yeah. I think if I think back to my 20s, 30s, and 40s even, it seemed like there was a lot to sort out and work out and be with. So it just seems, surprising, but not in a way, because I think I wanted that and worked hard to do that. You know, that's really been a pretty strong focus in my life, has been my own healing inner journey and outer presence in the world.
So what was fraught is not so much anymore.
That's true.
Yeah. Wow, neat. You brought some music, and the one you wanted to start the show with is Birdsong by the Waylon Jennies.
Yes.
Do you want to say something about that before we play it?
I think it kind of fits with what I've been talking about, wanting to be in the world in the way the song talks about, free and like a bird.
Okie doke.
So
this is a Canadian group.
Right? Yes.
From out west. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I love this group. They're a beautiful group of women singers.
Everything.
And that was the Waylon Jennies and Birdsong. And I'd like to be the silence. And there's one of the lines that's buried in there in one of the earlier verses. It's a powerful song. And we were just joking, the Waylon Jennies, that means the singing mules or workhorses. I mean, that's one of the ways that we interpret it from rural life in Missouri. So how did you come to know these musicians and why that song?
Well, actually, when I bought a used car from someone that I knew, when she passed the car along to me, she passed along this CD of the Wailing Jennies. So I popped it in the new CD player, and I immediately fell in love with their music. I love the harmonies of the women singing, and the soulfulness of their music really speaks to me. Mm-hmm. So, and that song just speaks to me about wanting to be. Really be present, I guess.
Be present in that morning when the bird song breaks the silence. So let's start. What's a major experience, or what are some of the experiences that have helped to bring you to where you are? You know, where'd you get started, and how have you traveled this path to now?
Well, I was thinking this morning about it, and I would say that it's the coming in of life, having had the great honor of having two daughters, and the going out of life, and having had the experience of being present with both of my parents, and 2 years ago with my partner when she died. So death has been a teacher for me in a profound way, and I think it's probably the greatest teacher that I've had.
And how would you characterize the lessons learned?
Well, that it's much bigger than how we see it often in our lives here in our human bodies, going about our day-to-day life. I think that was the thing that touched me each time. I really got to be with, like I said, I was at the moment of passing with both parents and my partner, and so that sense of presence, of birth, of something bigger being there, and some kind of passage.
Something closes, but something opens up.
Yeah.
And what changed? What in that opening did you what did you experience closing, and what did you experience opening?
I would say honestly that the closing was some kind of narrow perception for me, and the opening was certainly my heart, and something, a sense of mystery that I want to experience and think we can encounter anytime.
What was narrow about the way you were before you were with these three deaths?
I think just really caught up in the day-to-day struggle, which felt like struggle of life, and the seeking to get what we think we need to have, which is all legitimate, but there's more to the story than that. And where we look, I guess, is I think that's what I learned. I learned a little bit more about where I wanted to be looking for meaning and for a sense of what it is to be a human being.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm. In relationships, especially intimate relationships, we so much focus on the person so much of the time that we forget to see that person is part of the entire fabric of all of our experience. So when they die, I think what opens up is we no longer have that limited perspective, and we begin to see traces of their impact of our lives kind of throughout the universe, throughout the space around us. That's another way which things mm-hmm. can widen open. And you talked about how you don't focus or hold so dearly, or maybe even I've read this a little desperately, the day-to-day stuff that gets in the way, but letting it go and letting it become more soft and more pliable.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel a little less on the gerbil wheel or caught up in it, which is a real gift, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Being a regular occupier of the gerbil wheel.
Yes. I tend to notice more now when I find myself on it. I can hear the squeaky mm-hmm, mm-hmm. wheel going. Yeah. And,
So that helps to explain the intense focus on being present now.
I mean, my partner, Sarah, died a little over 2 years ago, and she'd been ill for 5 years mm-hmm. with cancer. And mm-hmm. When you're with somebody who's living at the end of their life and they relatively know it, even though there's treatment, it's a really different way of being in the world when you can see its end. Mm-hmm. And there's a preciousness there that taught me an enormous amount about how life can be if we understand that, you know, it's finite and we don't know how long we have to be here. And so it really, I think it has, yeah, I want to keep living that way, mm-hmm. even though I don't have the same sense for myself as clearly as she did mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. the end may be near. Of course it could be. But.
Right. And precious is a word that has two exact opposite meanings. And one is extremely special and worth noting or observing with great affection and regard. And the other one is overly imbued with meaning. When people like the hit song that was out several years ago, "Live Like You Were Dying," you know, it just kind of like it overdid that. And it was on the charts for so long.
Huh, I don't even know the song. That's kind of funny.
But I have a feeling you mean something different by precious than what was that ballad that was just belted out, you know. What is it? What changes when you hold something as precious? Living your life to the end of the life.
Wow, that's a hard one to... I guess I keep thinking about sitting with Sarah. We like to share our morning tea together and over as long as we could take with it. And, mm-hmm. you know, so if the sunrise was particularly notable and we were up to see that, or a bird came to the bird feeder and you paused to really, there was just something about the whole beauty of life being there, right there, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and to actually feel that, not be distracted by whatever's going on in the mind or the list of things to do that day or the pressure to get somewhere. So I guess that's what I mean, that it just, the real sense that at any moment we can stop and mm-hmm. notice that we've been given this enormous gift, like to be able to see the sunrise, to see the bird, to mm-hmm. see the flower, mm-hmm. to hear the bird song, to walk up the mountain, to swim in our beautiful lake.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just illustrated that it's you discover in the moment what's magnificent, and you don't go looking for it.
Exactly.
And a lot of people, I think, have this romantic notion of to live like you are dying is to go out and try to accomplish or do those things you never really got around to. Mm-hmm. But most of that's a bit of a farce. I mean, some of it you will do. But much of it is just becoming much more awed by what is just there already that you didn't notice before, that you couldn't value or that you had no clue.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I know when it became more obvious that Sarah was coming to the end of her life, she would talk about how she didn't really have a bucket list,
mm-hmm.
that it was all right here. And she just wanted to be with the people that she loved and in her home. And you know, I that kind of contentment or sense that, mm-hmm. of course it would have been nice to do a lot of other things, but it's not necessary to notice, you know, to feel that something has been fully given and completed.
Mm-hmm.
Neat.
Can we cut to another song? Do you have one you'd like to go to next?
Yeah, I think the one by my brother Richie, because he wrote this about his dear bandmate who was dying, and I love this song, so it is, I lost it here. Hold on one sec.
We are community radio, and we're making it up as we go.
I Am With You Always by Richie Stearns and Rosie Newton.
I am with you always, though you cannot see. I hold your hand from the other side, the circle is complete. You will go where I'm gone, and I'll wait patiently. And I am with you always, we will always. Thank you. feet around the edges, our love will always grow. I am with you always, though you cannot see. I hold your hand from the other side, the circle is complete. You will go where I've gone, and I'll wait patiently. And I am with you always, queen. We'll always be.
And that was Richie Stearns. And, let me just, I lost my notes here. Richie Stearns and Rosie Newton, and I am always with you, or I'm with you always.
Yes.
I get the words in the right order here, sooner or later. One of the things that often shocks people in our culture is that death is not something, when you embrace it, it isn't like kind of maudlin or kind of a shutting down. It's actually an opening up. Is how you present it. How has your experience of these three deaths changed what you're doing now with your own life?
I think it's changed everything, really. Because mm-hmm. It changes how you live your life when you live it, mm-hmm. knowing that death is part of it. But it's also become a really, because it's been such a meaningful and formative experience for me, I've become very passionate about talking about it and about encouraging people to not be so afraid about death and to mm-hmm. be able to meet it when it's coming, either to us individually or to someone that we love, because we live in a time and a culture where basically, we don't die, or we try not to die. I think we lose something enormously precious when we refuse to meet it. So,
and how is it? You know, you are now doing more reflection and kind of work on yourself and with other people to meet it. What are you doing? How, that's kind of what I was getting at. Vocationally, uh-huh. It's affected your work life, even.
Yeah, well, volunteer-wise, mm-hmm. I'm a volunteer at HospiCare here in Ithaca, mm-hmm. and I've helped to have a grief film series brought there with some really good films for people who are grieving, because mm-hmm. I also think that's very much a part of it, is that we also have to be grievers. We have to do the work of grief. I've also been paired up with people who are dying as a volunteer. Anything that I can do to support the organization. This week I'm going to help coordinate the Thanksgiving dinner at HospiCare for the residents and their families. So it just means a lot to me to be part of it. My partner Sarah was also a hospice volunteer while she was sick, and mm-hmm. I feel like I'm able to carry that on in her honor as well. And the services that HospiCare gave to my family, both when my mother died and when Sarah was dying, was just amazingly supportive. Mm-hmm.
What is the support that they offer? Because that's a question I often get asked
uh-huh.
by families. How does hospice really make a difference?
Well, they have great nursing services and social work. And they really just embrace this incredibly difficult time in someone's life when you want, as a family member, you hope to be able to just be present with the person that you're, that is leaving us. And, mm-hmm. They really make that possible. When my mom was dying, it was such a relief to turn over the care in terms of the medical stuff and have somebody really hold it. I mean, you could call them 24/7, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they appear if you needed them in within hours or even within an hour. You know?
Right.
So they're just really there to make it so that your job as a family member is just to be able to be with your loved one.
Right, right. To be in the supportive and the engaged relationship, but not be responsible for the routine care.
Yeah, and to be able to sort out, you know, what does this person really need as they're maybe in pain or whatever's happening. Mm-hmm. They know how to do that. Mm-hmm. And they do it well. They do it very well.
You had noted you're studying. Are you studying about hospice or dying or grief work?
I'm studying with someone named Stephen Jenkinson, who has a school called the Orphan Wisdom School in Canada. Hmm. He's featured in a film called Grief Walker, which is about end of life. It's mm-hmm. about living, knowing that you're going to die, and how that changes, you know, how we live our lives, and really addresses the death phobia that we as a people seem to be rampantly mm-hmm. living with. And so, yeah, it's been a beautiful, really powerful experience. Really, it's about living, not about living, knowing that dying is part of living. And
Right. And also, I'm thinking of the concept of grace and how when you're in a graceful state, it doesn't matter whether you're aware of living or dying, you're unselfconscious.
Yeah.
And sometimes the grief work can be, you have to be so self-conscious that you can let it go and move on to a space of being unselfconscious grace and just being present and with others without any mm-hmm. any notion of direction or meaning. It's just presence.
Yeah, sure.
You brought it's a Rumi poem that's being translated by Coleman Barks that's read by Kim Rosen. Is that the listening Jamie Seiber?
Oh, did you find it with the poem in it?
I found it with the poem in it.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
So do you...
There's also an instrumental version. I have both, but...
Okay, do you want to go with the poem?
Yeah, let's go with the poem, sure. Because I think it's interesting that that's what came up for you, so the poem must belong here.
Yes. And I think that's partly because, I went down through several layers of...
Yeah, yeah.
...of trying to find it, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm curious now.
Whoops. Okay, we're having another technical difficulty here. I need
the cable. The iPod?
Yeah, I need the cable.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. So this is a selection for the instrumental background by Jamie Seiber.
Seiber,
and but it's being there's a narration of a poem by Rumi called Listening.
What is the deep listening? Sama is a greeting from the secret ones inside the heart, a letter. The branches of your intelligence grow new leaves in the wind of this listening. The body reaches a peace. Rooster sound comes reminding you of your love for dawn, the reed flute and the singer's lips, the knack of how spirit breathes into us becomes as simple and ordinary as eating and drinking. The dead rise with the pleasure of listening. If someone can't hear a trumpet melody, sprinkle dirt on his head and declare him dead. Listen and feel the beauty of your separation. The unsayable absence. There's a moon inside every human being. Learn to be companions with it. give more of your life to this listening. As brightness is to time, so you are to the one who talks to the deep ear in your heart. I should sell my tongue and buy 1,000 ears when that one steps near and begins to speak. I should sell my tongue and buy 1,000 ears when that one steps near.
And that was a poem by Rumi, played with a cello piece behind it by Jamie Sieber. And our guest on this hour is Carrie Stearns, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And I'm Eric Clay, your host. So Carrie, what have you learned over the years that's forced you to change kind of a deep commitment? And that's one way we kind of approach these change questions. And the flip side is, what have you learned that you've had to become more resolved in that you didn't necessarily value as much, but you had it from the beginning? You know, these are ways of getting at our sense of how we embrace, engage, and roll with the world.
I think what I would most say for myself right now is learning to let life in as it is, and be a much less judgmental person, because judgmentalness felt justified to me in a certain way for a long time, as a sort of a protection. Mm-hmm. So keeping things, you know, if you feel like you know what's right and what's wrong and how it should be, then somehow you believe that you can control and make the world be an okay place. So I think I've learned that doesn't serve me or life or anyone else.
How did you discover your own judgmentalness? What were you doing? What were you feeling that you became aware of? And because these are the kinds of observations that help people who may be stuck.
Well, I actually did some very intensive spiritual, psychological work through a school called the Ridwan School, or Diamond Heart, or Diamond Approach, which involves a lot of inquiry into your own experience. And we did it in group retreats along with, so for about 7-8 years, I attended these retreats and really dived into looking at my own experience of how I am with people, how I am with myself, how I am with the world, and began to uncover, you know, kind of that shell that we tend to put around ourselves that isn't really our true nature. It's our defense,
right,
into the world.
And how did that shell manifest itself? What were you doing that you saw then as a shell? You came to see as a shell.
Yeah, I think I just got that sense about the narrowness in which I was trying to keep life in this way that made it appear to be safe to me. And, you know, the dissecting that we do of, I'll take some of this and I'll get rid of that, and maybe a little more.
This is really good, but that's not so good, and I'm going to get away from that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And at some point, I think we discover that actually doesn't work.
Did it affect your parenting?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I would definitely say it's affected my parenting.
And what has changed in your relationship with your kids as you have tried to let go of that sense that you know what's right or wrong for them?
Yeah, I guess it would be interesting to hear what they would say. I don't think I did a lot of parenting that approached things as though I knew what was right for them.
Right. More that you knew what was right for the for you or the world.
For the world, yeah. Much more arrogant.
Well, but actually more arrogant but less aimed, so they may not have suffered under it.
I don't think they've suffered as much under it. The beauty of watching, I've always believed that children are not for us to shape and form. They already have their own, they come in with their own shape and form that needs to be allowed to unfold. So I've had the pleasure of holding that for them as best I could. I'm mm-hmm. by no means a perfect mother. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is one, and I wouldn't strive to be that. But
right, and I have a less. I mean, I still hear a certain amount of idealism in terms of the form. I have more of a sense that we wear both the caresses and the scars of the lives that we've lived, and we bump up against each other in ways that really support each other, but also damage each other, and becoming less defensive about justifying that, but rather just fully experiencing it allows us to wear scars that are meaningful to us and meaningful to others, but also to not hold them as grudges and to be tender.
Yeah, I'm with you. I one of moment that I remember in the Diamond Heart work that I did was my main teacher, who actually died of cancer herself in 2008. But she, I came to that realization as we're studying our own, you know, impressions that came to us as children and how that's shaped us, and mm-hmm. you know, that the inevitability of realizing as a parent that how much you've screwed it up, you know, and what, you know, asking her, what am I going to do about this? And she just sort of smiled and laughed and said, just every time you notice it, just put another dollar in the therapy jar, knowing that it's inevitable that, you know, our children will also have to figure some things out about the impression that they were left with by us, and that there will be some wounds and scars, and mm-hmm. that's not actually such a bad thing. It's necessary, actually. I think my own wounding and being willing to look clearly at it has actually been a gift to me. And, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, there's a wonderful Rumi poem that talks about don't turn away from the wounded place. It's where the light enters you, and that's something I've really taken to heart in my life and in my work mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. people.
One of the when you see how people handle disconfirming feedback, things that challenge what they assume to be true or challenge what they were working toward, first you notice whether they've noticed them or not. Because, you know, if they're kind of on a tear in their own direction, they don't even notice that kind of feedback. And then you notice if they be defensive about it, and if they mm-hmm. if they don't get defensive about it, then you see whether it makes them sad or whether it makes them curious. And then, you know, and then you can see, well, mm-hmm. with that sadness, do they shut down or do they continue to engage till they come to some point of curiosity about what's happening here and how could it be?
Yeah.
How could this be, and how could I be that I need to see or learn this particular?
Yeah, curiosity. That's the key word, I think, that you're talking about.
Yeah.
That we could bring to many, many things, mm-hmm. and it would open it, you know, would bring more space in.
How did you come to curiosity? Or how have you come to curiosity?
I think it's always been with me. I think I always had a sense that there's something bigger and mysterious mm-hmm. about life that I really wanted to know about. I almost picked a song from Bruce Coburn, 'cause he was my first musician that I that seemed to speak of this more mystical mm-hmm. quality of life. So as a teenager, you know, I came upon his music, and so that I would say that it was with me always, really. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how did the curiosity get enveloped in something that you would have called judgment?
How did it get it?
Yeah, because you talked about having a strong sense of judgment, which is oftentimes, I mean, they can work together, but oftentimes judgment shuts down curiosity. But many times it's like casting a line for fishing. You know, your curiosity and your judgment brings it back, and then it can be a dynamic process. But for you, you described it more as being within a case of your own assessment, opinions, and having to break that open to a purer curiosity. That's my word.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. Certain point, you notice how what's constraining you, what's making life narrow. And
But how did life become more narrow for you?
How did it become more narrow?
Right. Because you've had the curiosity from the beginning.
Right. I grew up in a very chaotic family, the youngest of six, and my father was struggled with alcoholism, and it was pretty rough.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's where a lot of that came from, was that sense that the good and bad, you know, the beginning to really think I could separate it out, because somehow that made it all be bearable.
Well, but it also gave you an identity. If I judge what's going on around me, then there's a me here.
Exactly.
And this environment where I'm the sixth of six kids, I'm the sixth of seven kids, or the seventh of eight, one died before me. So it's you claim that in a way that at times is almost more reactive than it needs to be, just to have something.
Sure. No, absolutely. It's that's what we do.
And the six kids would be chaotic even if there weren't addiction issues.
Right.
No, that gives me a strong bit of insight. And judgment's not a bad thing. It's just it's just one of many things.
Right. It just doesn't serve. I would like to have less of it, because I think I would that preciousness will be more. There'll be a little more room for it.
Right. And I think there's a difference between judgment, which is projected out, as opposed to when you've experienced something, assessing and judging what it is that's coming back into you.
Oh, yeah, that's very different.
You want to be judgmental in the sense of assessing what it is you're experiencing and identifying it accurately and honoring what other people are saying. You want to be able to, and being able to critique that. You want that kind of judgment, but you don't necessarily want to project what's going to be or slather people with a brush that they wouldn't paint themselves with.
Right, and for me, it really became a coat of armor to keep certain things and people away, which... Mm-hmm.
Me too.
I think I'm ready to shed it a little bit more here.
Yeah. And it seems like you are. And where you are is in a quiet space. And what I would see is that there may well be a much more active space in the future that is in the moment, but not so still in the moment.
You know? Could be.
And that's the grief, I think, is stillness. Mm-hmm. And we need to stay with the stillness until we're ready to move. Mm-hmm. But we are made for motion. As human beings with bodies and minds and hearts. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'd say it's beginning to move for me, for sure.
Cool. Cool. You brought more music. You think about where we go next, and I'm going to do the idea again. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Carrie Stearns. So Peter Bradley Adams, From the Sky.
Are you tired from the battles fought? All the years that you won or lost? Are you tired? Shaken from it all. Are you scared that you'll lose control as you cling to the words you know? In the silence, you start to lose your hope. In the silence, you dream. Thank you. as your breathing slows, as the stillness around you grows, there's a sound that you have always known. There's a sound familiar to your bones, and maybe the clouds will open wide, and maybe you'll let us see smile from the sky.
Peter Bradley Adams from The Sky. And our guest on this hour is Carrie Stearns. Carrie, one of the ways that I like to close this show down in the last 10 minutes is to reflect on what it is, for the guest to reflect on what it is that you do to restore your sense of balance, your sense of optimism or strength. How do you deal with life when things get you down, or just how do you maintain kind of an even keel so that you're kind of on top of what's going on? So what do you do?
I really work to begin my day slow and in the quiet, with meditation, reading. Mm-hmm. So I've actually created a work life that works for me to begin my days that way. So, mm-hmm. And I try not to live in a frantic pace of life because mm-hmm. it doesn't suit me well at all. And I don't do my best work from that place. So really it's for me, the, how I begin my day shapes a lot about how my day is. And so that's one strong intention that I bring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's a daily practice in
yes.
the morning of how you embrace or meet or whatever mm-hmm. verb you want to use to start the day.
Yes.
What else do you do? And sometimes I say, people, we need to kind of take care of ourselves intellectually, emotionally, and physically. And when you get those three very different things working together, then I think you've got a person's spirit, in terms of
right.
the way they all right. interplay. What do you do in those different ways to take care of yourself?
Well, I certainly like to get out and, walk and be in nature mm-hmm. Or work in the garden when it's that time of year. Very passionate about growing anything. Mm-hmm. I have a small backyard, so I can't grow a lot, but I pretty much use it for flowers and vegetables and whatever I can. And then eating well and cooking. I cook at the Light on the Hill Retreat Center.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my jobs, and I love to cook for people. I love nourishing food. I like the sense of the hearth
mm-hmm.
and bringing that into our lives. So, that really balances and grounds me a lot. Let's see. Yeah.
Where did you learn that skill of cooking for groups?
I think I really learned it from really needing to be able to cook in order to, be helpful mm-hmm. in my family and mm-hmm. to my mother, and that she loved it. And so I think her love of good food and the offering of it, touched me. And it's something that I just think it's so essential to our, and we're losing it, we can go to Wegmans now and just buy already chopped vegetables or a whole meal already prepared.
Already even chopped organic vegetables.
That's right. So it's like we don't have to be connected in any way. So for me, there's something about that connection to growing, touching, mm-hmm. chopping, cooking the food, and then eating it, and preferably with people. That really, really does give me life.
Right, right, right. I interviewed Shoshana Perry on the show a couple of months ago, and she had a very similar approach to food, and she also cooks it.
Like, yes, she does, yeah.
Yeah, that's neat, yeah. That's neat.
Yeah.
One of the things about living in a culture that is as affluent as this one, we can pick and choose what we care about and what we engage in, the kind of depth that you talk about. How that ability to pick and choose, even your own choosing, implies a certain kind of willfulness. We see that more clearly when you go to Wegmans and you can have your consumer demands met in any particular willful way you want to get them. But we also do it in our own lives by what we choose to pay attention to. Yet it's also one of the most important spiritual challenges is to step away from willfulness and to engage what others would will for us as much as what we would will for ourselves. How do you deal with that push and pull from opposite, you know? From what you generate inside yourself versus what's presented to you as something to consider doing that would take your time or emotion.
I'm not sure if I'm understanding your question fully.
It's a tough question.
Uh-huh.
So let me try to back up. I'm going to say this is a very different sort of story. When I was ordained as a minister, you know, nearly 27 years ago, or 28 years ago, the elder in the congregation who was part of the group that ordained me said, you need to know that what you care about today is not going to be what you're going to care about 10 years from now. And when you look back on the person that you were 10 years ago, you're not in some fundamental sense going to recognize that person because you will have, if you're fully engaged mm-hmm. in living, have moved on to a different set of concerns, you will be in that new moment. And part of getting there is taking seriously the concerns and the demands of those around you while not making yourself slavish to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's letting go of saying, this is what spirituality is for me, and saying, it's also what it is for other people or what they need for me.
Hmm.
You know, that's so my question is, how do you open yourself to agendas that are not your own and to engage them, to let you know that the people around you are really dear to you and their causes are your causes, even if you don't agree with them?
I think it's just being in conversation mm-hmm. and listening. Listening mm-hmm. is a huge...
Yeah.
part, being willing to really hear where people are and not, it goes back to that judgmental thing, mm-hmm, not mm-hmm. not engaging the judge or the
it's
critic.
It's the antidote
yeah.
to that. Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, even I've been drawn to what's happening around Seneca Lake and the Crestwood company wanting to store natural gas there. And I was an activist for a long time before I had children, and was arrested many times for mm-hmm. anti-war demonstrating and peacemaking. And but it disturbs me, like, that we can be so oppositional too in the way that we engage our mm-hmm. struggle. So I was watching a little video clip of some protesters out in British Columbia doing a very similar thing against a corporation there and the pipeline, and it was beautiful to see people gathered, and it hurt my heart when I saw the protesters chanting shame, shame, shame at the mm-hmm. people that were going in, and remember doing it myself mm-hmm. as a young activist. And so in some way that's an answer to your question.
That
we're not gonna
question.
Stand and as though we have all the answers and know what's right and they're wrong, and
right.
that's just creating more of the same.
Justice is not self-righteousness.
Right. So, but at the same time, how do we really show up to say that this right. is not okay, and this is not a safe choice,
right.
and this is not what the earth is
Or simply to ask the question, can we do better?
Yes.
Take me seriously enough to talk with me about how can we do better.
Right. And so it's a we and not a us and them. And,
yeah.
And I want to learn more about the we, because like I already shared with you, I have some work to do still to move that out of the way.
Your last song that you brought was If It Be Your Will by Leonard Cohen.
Yes.
And it seems like we've come to kind of a fitting spot for that.
Yeah, so. That is. You led right into it.
I didn't know that I was doing it. So it was, yeah.
Yeah, no, I love this song. I think it's, it places it where it needs to be.
And to take oneself out of center.
That's right. And it's letting something else be our guide and our, let what's bigger hold us. And
right.
So.
Right, right. So, Carrie, it has been wonderful to get to know you a bit.
And you, Eric, thank you.
And and so we'll close with Leonard Cohen, If It Be Your Will.
If it be your will that I speak no more and my voice be still as it was before, I will speak no more. I shall abide until I am spoken for. If it be your will, if it be your will, be true from this broken hill. I will sing to you from this broken hill. All your praises they shall ring. If it be your will to let me sing.
And that was Leonard Cohen, If It Be Your Will. And our guest on this past hour of the Made of Clay Report was Carrie Stearns.